Welcome to another episode of Christian Combatives Podcast. I'm your host and servant in Jesus Christ, Paladin. Actually, we have another scatterbrain Bible study for you today. In this Bible study, we mainly go through James chapter 1. Some of the things we talk about some of the perspectives on the book of James and its controversy in Scripture. We talk about testing versus tempting versus trials. We talk about setting up roadblocks and speed bumps to keep temptation from turning into full-fledged active sin. We ask the question, is temptation itself a sin? I take a quick detour to talk about the trials that Job went through and whether or not it was a true story, and we get prepared and hyped up for James chapter 2, which is quite spicy. Hope you all enjoy. God bless. Take care.
People were complaining about James. Luther referred to James as an epistle of straw, but then later on he talked about James differently. This is one of the books that people were not sure if it was 100% in the scripture, if it was canon, if it was in every single church. The term is antilegomena. Or antilegomena, I can't remember the pronunciation. There's homolegomena and antilegomena. Homo meaning like or same, and anti meaning not the same. So the difference being some books like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those are in every single church's library. Every church had a copy of that had a copy of the book, the copy of the Bible at all. James was one of the letters that not every church had a copy of it. That doesn't mean that necessarily it wasn't a part of the Bible. It's just literally that's all it means. It wasn't in every church library. That's it. It wasn't as common as everything else. So James was one of these books that there was questions about who was the author, who was it really written to, etc. They wanted to be very careful. They weren't just sticking random books in the Bible and saying, any book that anybody comes out with and says, hey, I've got a Gospel of Thomas. Yeah, let's just throw that in there next to the Gospel of Mary. They weren't doing that. The Christian church was actually very careful about, like, they knew who letters were from. So if you got a letter from somebody, and I'm trying to think of somebody, let's say you got a letter from St. Paul or whatever. You know St. Paul, I know St. Paul, you know St. Paul. You got a letter from Paul and you talked to him and yeah, that's for sure his letter. In fact, his buddy delivered that letter to you. Well, I'll take a copy of that letter and I'll give you a copy of that letter and we'll all have a copy of this letter from Paul. But I know it was from Paul because I talked to you and you got it from Paul. You got it from Paul's, servant Epaphroditus directly. So there's confirmation. They weren't just throwing random books in and saying, we'll just make the Bible however we want to. So there's also levels of reliability. So if Matthew says, hey, my name is Matthew the Apostle, here is the gospel account that I wrote. That's pretty, okay, I know Matthew. This is Matthew giving me the gospel account. I now have Matthew's gospel account. That's pretty solid. If, however, you say, hey, I got a letter titled to the Hebrews. Who is the author? I don't remember, but I got it from somebody who got it from somebody who got it from somebody who's connected to the apostles or the evangelists. But I don't remember who it was from. I remember he had an eye patch and, but I remember that we trusted, that the people who got it, they trusted him or whatever. So there's a level of, okay, the church that received the letter of the Hebrews, they trusted the author of the Hebrews, they included it. They said, yes, this is worth including, but they neglected to write down who actually wrote the letter. So we know it was somebody that they trusted. We don't know specifically who it was. Was it Paul? Was it Apollos? Was it maybe Mark? Who knows? So there's different levels of reliability. This doesn't mean that something is or isn't the Bible. This doesn't mean we should just rip books out of the Bible. But this does mean that, we can engage our brain a little bit as Christians and say, this book was in every church's library. This book was not. This book was widely known. Everybody knew who wrote it and everybody had a copy of it. This book, nobody's quite sure who has it, but a lot of churches had copies of it, and they all considered it official, so we'll include that as well. Martin Luther was not the first one to call out this distinction between the homolegomena and the antilegomena. He was not the only one. It's common sense. It's like saying the sky is blue or whatever. It's just a fact that, the different letters had different levels of backing, I suppose, for their authorship. All right, so because of that, James is one of these letters where there's a little bit of controversy about authorship, about it wasn't in every church's library, etc. That being said, if you actually read Luther's commentaries on it and his introductions to it, one of his earlier introductions, he refers to it as an epistle of straw. I've heard some explanation that an epistle of straw means, straw was very useful, but it was also everywhere. So it wasn't, it's useful so far as it goes, but it wasn't particularly rich in theological content. James is not a book that has a lot of gospel in it. It's a book that has a lot of kind of practical daily living type stuff. So like the Book of Esther, for example, you could consider something like that. The Book of Esther doesn't have a lot about God, but it has some history and some neat little things. And it's good for what it is, but it's not the Book of Psalms, right? That's the distinction that Luther is making here when he calls it an epistle of straw. And of course, later on, he'll talk about, you know, that he loves this book and it's actually a wonderful book. So sometimes people will accuse Luther of wanting to rip it out of the Bible. Luther says a lot of stuff. read this stuff later on in his life to see if he ever changed his mind. Anyways, let's begin. James chapter 1. Hopefully you've all gotten there by now. James chapter 1 begins like this. James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes in the dispersion, greetings. So rather than writing on the outside of your letter, like to and from and stuff like that, this is written at the beginning of the letter. So this is who's writing it, James, and this is who it is directed to, the 12 tribes. The 12 tribes in the dispersion. All right, testing your faith. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds, for you know that the testing of your faith produces steadfastness. And let steadfastness have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. All right, so right out of the gate, he's addressing trials, he's addressing challenges. Count it all joy, my brothers. This is a tough thing to tell somebody who's suffering. Count it as joy that you're going through a time of testing right now. This is actually something God is using for good. The testing of your faith produces steadfastness. Now, this is true, and I wish it wasn't sometimes, because it would be nicer if God was just like, okay, here, have a wonderful life, and because I'm giving you a wonderful life, you have wonderful faith. The reality is a lot of times your faith is tested. And if your faith endures through that testing, it becomes stronger. And I'm sure there's all kinds of metallurgical, blacksmithing type, working the iron type things where the more stress you put the iron under or something like that, you have to create a stronger product that way. You have to temper the iron by putting it through heat first to make it stronger. But this is basically talking about you're going to be going through trials and testing, and bad stuff is going to be happening in your life, but God has not abandoned you, and he's actually using it to make you more resilient. You will notice as you go through life and you go through particular situations of suffering and stuff, maybe they're even unique to you or they're special to you. They're not very common types of suffering. Or maybe they're more common. There's, you know, people in your family get sick, or there's divorce, or there's some sort of pain or something like that. As you go through these things, you are now better able to serve fellow Christians going through them. So if you have gone through a horrible illness and you've made it through to the other side and you've retained your faith, now you've got another Christian who's going through a similar illness, you can start giving them comfort. You have actually been built up by your trial, and now God can use you to love other people who have not yet gone through the trial, who want to know, hey, is there light on the other end of the tunnel? And you could say, yes, I've been through the tunnel. There is light on the other end. There is life after this. There is, you know, there is reason to keep trusting in God. Let's keep going. Verse 5, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded, unstable in all his ways. So again, while you're reading through James, a lot of this is kind of practical advice and encouragement, things like that. In this case, ask God for wisdom. Confidently ask God for wisdom as somebody who will give it to you. Don't approach God and say, well, you know, God hates me. He's not going to give me wisdom, but I'll reluctantly ask him. Because treat God as somebody who cares about you and who loves you while you approach him to ask him for things. All right. I'll keep going until you guys stop me. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation. Let the rich in his humiliation, because like a flower in the grass, he will pass away. For the sun rises with its scorching heat and withers the grass. Its flowers fail, its beauty perishes. So also will the rich man fade away in the midst of his pursuits. Maybe you're thinking about the rich man who built the towers for his grain. And he says, now I have all the wealth and all the things that I need. And he goes to sleep, and God says to him, you fool, tonight your life will be required of you. So it is silly to boast in all the things that you have in life that God can take away from you, just as he's given them to you in the first place. probably not something to trust in. On the contrary, verse 12, blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. The desire, when it's conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death. There's a lot in this chunk of text in particular. So there's one problem that we have. I guess we kind of try to fix it in English. It's more of a problem in Greek because sometimes the same word is used to mean tempt and test. You know what the difference between tempting and testing is? For a test, you're expected to pass. In theory, when a teacher gives you a test, it is because he or she knows that you will pass the test. You've been prepared for the test. Now, when you complete the test, then you can be verified. They can say, yes, this person knows this content. Or maybe it helps you. It helps encourage you as well. You said, well, I wasn't really sure that I knew this content, but I passed the test. So I guess I do. I guess I do know this.
That's why they should not call it an eye test.
An eye test? They should call it an eye temptation?
Eye exam.
Eye exam. Okay. Exam. They want to see where you are, whereas
you
a test.
You can't pass it if you can't see.
I guess. Yeah, you are correct. But in this case, in a test versus a temptation. Temptation, on the other hand, think about Jesus in the wilderness being tempted for 40 days by the devil. The goal of the temptation is not to give you a test that you can easily pass. The goal of the temptation is to get you to fail. That's the goal. So in this case, we can read this. God does test people. You read the previous verses, this is true. God does indeed test people. God allows temptation to come to people. God allows trials to come into people's life. But God never gives you something with the hope that you'll fail. He never gives you a temptation and say, I hope you fall into sin. My goal is to tempt you into sin. So there's a big distinction there. Let no one say when he was tempted, I am tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. All right, but each person is tempted when he is lured, enticed by his own desire. So this starts talking about kind of the practical steps that lead to sin. And this makes a lot of sense when we kind of break it down and think about sin in our own lives. Okay, first, verse 14, when a person is tempted, he is lured and enticed by desire. So the first step is there's a lure, there's an enticement of desire. So let's pick a sin like stealing a candy bar from the store. All right. So the first thing is you see that shiny Hershey's wrapper, and you don't have any money in your pockets, but you see that chocolate bar over there. I'm saying this because I may have, when I was 3, taken a chocolate bar from the store. I made it all the way to the car until I was caught. Chocolate all over my face. It was melted because I had it in my pocket and everything. I had to go back and talk to the security guard and everything. I was terrified. I was forgiven, thankfully. But still, it begins with that desire, that tempted, that lured enticement. Oh man, that looks like a good piece of chocolate. Then desire, so verse 15, then desire, when it has conceived, gives birth to sin. So there's a temptation, and like keeping that temptation around. It's like, have you ever seen those videos where they're training a dog and they put like a piece of food in front of the dog and the dog is like staring at it and just drool is dripping down, especially like a Doberman, just drool is puddling down. And the longer the dog stares at it, the more he wants that treat. That's how sin is. And something that I try to help people with who ask me about sin online on a regular basis, I say, I'm constantly falling into these same sins. And a question to ask is, okay, are you putting something that tempts you in front of yourself? Now, your willpower may be what it is. You may sin or not. Maybe you've got really great willpower. But the fact of the matter is, if you're not supposed to be eating pumpkin pie and you sit down and you've got a slice of pumpkin pie, and so help you, you've got a fork and you've got some whipped cream and it's all set up, that's going to be a lot harder to resist than, okay, I don't have pumpkin pie at the house and they're not selling it at Costco this time of year. That's easy to resist. It's not in front of you. So there is a very practical reality here where if you are making temptations themselves, which are not sin, you see pumpkin pie. If you see a chocolate bar in the candy store today and you're like, I could steal that. If you see, like the temptation to be like, I kind of want that candy bar, that itself maybe not be a sin, but if you put this temptation in front of yourself, the more you see it, the more it talks about it like birth. It is conceived. So it goes from temptation, then it's conceived into sin, and then the sin is fully born from there. So the longer you have it there, the more you let it grow, the more likely it is to give birth to actual acted out sin. And when it is fully grown, brings forth death, which is an interesting analogy that, like, you're talking about growing, like, conception and then growing, and then rather than giving birth to life, gives birth to death. It's an interesting contrast there. So one of the practical things that I'll tell a lot of the people is I'll say, they come to me with these problems, I'll say, okay, what are you doing to put obstacles in front of yourself to this sin? Don't buy pie if you're not supposed to eat pie. Don't, you know, because there's a lot of teenagers, in particular, I say, you know, don't go on these websites if you know where they're going to lead. If you have a family computer, maybe put it in the family room. And don't have private time with your phone and your computer in your own room. Like, practical things. If you're an alcoholic, don't keep alcohol in the house. If somebody you're living with is an alcoholic, then for their sake, to love them, don't put that temptation in front of them. So it's all, I mean, there are actual practical things. Again, this is not about, like, salvation. This is about what are the practical either roadblocks or speed bumps that will slow me down or stop me from rushing from, I see temptation, I conceive sin. All right. Yes. Yes, sir.
I had an old chief mass sergeant mm-hmm. I worked for, and he was giving up smoking.
Oh.
But the thing is, if he'd sat down to have a beer or whatever, he wanted that cigarette.
Yes.
So he ended up giving up beer, too.
Yeah. So I've heard similar stories where people have, it's either a kind of food or it's a kind of drink or something where they're trying to give up smoking. And then this other thing leads them. So not necessarily that he has a problem with drinking, but if drinking tempts him to smoke and he has a problem with smoking, maybe stopping drinking is it's just a practical reality. Somebody else had a comment, question? Yes, sir. So this has been kind of a theological debate for a while. So temptation itself isn't always, I'm going to say this as carefully as I can, it isn't always a sin. If you read the Lutheran confessions, there's something called concupiscence. If you've heard this word concupiscence, it means your sinful nature, your innate desire, because your human nature itself is not evil. But it has been infected with sin. Because it has been infected, you are inclined to sin. So concupiscence itself, your desire to sin naturally, without anybody else influencing you, just your desire to sin, that itself we would consider a sin. That being said, I generally say that temptation comes from three sources. One, it comes from inside, they're sinful, your concupiscence. Yourself, the devil, the world, and your sinful nature. So your sinful nature would be concupiscence. The devil, imagine Jesus being tempted in the wilderness. Jesus didn't sin, but Jesus was tempted. Externally, the devil was tempting him. Also, consider Matthew 16, verse, was it 22, something like that? It's around there. Jesus is telling Peter that he's going to go to the cross. And Peter says, no, may it not be, Lord. And what does Jesus say to Peter? Get thee behind me, Satan. So Peter, part of the world at this time, is trying to tempt Jesus to sin by abandoning the path of the cross. Now, Jesus doesn't sin, even though the temptation is there. So in the case of temptation, it can be a sin, or it can be a sin when it's coming from ourselves. But if it's external, if the devil is tempting us directly, or if somebody else is tempting us, the world is tempting us, I would say in that case, it's not a sin. It's not a sin because we know it happened to Jesus. Both the world and the devil tried to tempt him, and we know that Jesus didn't sin. Therefore, that's why I would say it's not a sin. Does that kind of answer what you were asking?
Or yeah, I was kind of focusing on that phrase, own desire.
Oh, for which verse? Yeah, so he's tempted by his own desire. So in that case, If you've got a sin corrupted nature, your desires are sinful. Out of the heart comes all kinds of wicked things, I believe. In that case, I would say because it's your own desire that's sinful, that is sin. But I would also say that there's, I mean, this is James. We're talking about practical. And we're not talking about salvation versus damnation type sin. Any sin, you know, is enough to get you to hell if Jesus didn't forgive you. But there is a difference between like, oh, I really want that pie. I really want that pie. And then just taking it and eating it. There's just a practical difference between you do that with the pie. I was just about to use an example of like attempted murder versus successful murder when you said that. I was like, oh no. But there's a difference between it is a crime to plot to murder somebody, even if you don't carry it out. It is also a crime to actually carry it out. And I would say probably in terms of the effect, it is a worse crime. It's just worse. The difference between premeditating the murder and actually doing it, when you actually do it, there's more damage done. But in both cases, it's a sin, yes. Yeah, the question is less about I become a sinner because I sinned, and more I sin because I'm a sinner. Exactly. Yeah. And this is one of the reasons why we have to look outside of ourselves for salvation and stuff. Because if we look inside of ourselves, we're going to see this bubbling La Brea tar pit that just keeps releasing this tar of sin until, you know, God works on that. Any other questions, comments before I keep going? Oh, yes, ma'am. Right. This is one of the frustrations Luther had with this, is because if you come into this book looking for laws on how to live and how to be a good person, you can find verses that sound like that. That's not what's going on here. What is going on implicitly is rather than me comparing myself to you and I'm a better person than you or you're a better person than me, is you compare yourself to Christ. Are you perfect? No, then you're not good enough. And this, the implicit comparison is to Christ. George, did you have something?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I found myself in the middle of a conversation before where this verse where they talk about tempted, they say it could also mean trials.
Yes.
Every English translation uses the word tempted. They never say trials.
Yeah, being tempted, trials, and testing. If this is the one, I'm pretty sure it's all the same Greek word. So we have to understand it by context in this way. So we use different words in the English based on the context. For example, we're not going to say that God is tempting you because the verse says that God doesn't tempt anybody. But we will say that God is putting you through a trial or that God is testing you. But even then, the words get confusing because you have verses like, test me, and like God invites you to test. Like he'll give you a promise and say test me. But then there's other verses that says that do not test the Lord your God. So we combine, like, we have to understand it based on the context, which is really weird because we Americans like different words for different things. So when we have tempting, trial, and testing, you just think in the back of your mind that that's the same Greek word. But what does it mean in the context? What could it possibly mean? You know that it can't mean that God is tempting you. So if that word is used with God doing something to you, trial, God absolutely allows you to go through trials or gives you trials to go through. Testing, God absolutely tests you to strengthen you, to give you endurance, to confirm your faith, to say, wow, I made it through that. Turns out God is really here for me after all. I would say that is absolutely a difficult, and you'll see in different translations, sometimes you'll see words translated a little bit differently here. The tempt, test, and trial. Just know that in the Greek, it's the same word. It has to be context. It has to be really delicately handled. Sure. I heard a pastor say this one time, and it's stuck in my head and I'm still chewing on it to see if I like the flavor. He says in any time when you're going through a challenge or a trial or anything like that, the question to ask is, what is God teaching me? Not did God allow this trial to come? Not am I a bad person? Did I deserve this? Anything like that? No, because some of those things like why did God allow this to happen to me is a question you probably can't answer 90% of the time. Sometimes God says, because it was necessary to fulfill all righteousness. You know, God will tell somebody. But most of the time something happens, just like, God, why did you allow this illness to happen to my family? And he doesn't tell you until you get to heaven. And then you go, oh, that's why. But in this case, in every time that you have a trial or a temptation or anything like that, you can ask the question, you say, what will God teach me from this thing? Some cases people are in sin and God gives them a trial in their life because they're really attached to a sin. Easy example, you've got somebody who's got a lot of money, they're really comfortable life, they're used to living with a lot of money, and then God puts a financial burden on them that they're not used to. Maybe they're so sinful, their sin is that they've ceased trusting in God, they're trusting in their money, and God takes away that comfort blanket of money, and now they have to turn to God. Sometimes that's the case, not always. I don't want to say this is always the case, but they can ask the question in that time. They can say, okay, I had money, now I don't have money. What can I learn from this? I can learn to trust God. Yes, sir?
How do you argue that the entire book of Job is a discussion of this? Mm-hmm. Right? And God's,
I love,
way oversimplifying it. God's answer is, are you the one that created this?
Yes.
Are you the one that...
Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? I'm sorry. Did I consult you when I built the universe? The sarcasm in God's... I love the book of Job, in particular the last section. After Job's one intelligent friend speaks, God doesn't even acknowledge him because he's right. But God doubles down on everything that he says, which is funny later on. And the question, like, Job didn't know the reason he was going through this trial and this temptation. Job did his fair bit of whining, but he didn't do what his wife said to curse God and die. He didn't do that. Thanks be to God. He was faithful. I've heard somebody say that so a lot of people have this question about Job, is they say, how come God, why did he engage in this game with the devil? The reality is that God tricked the devil into doing his work for him. However great Job's faith was before, when he had everything and he had the comfortable life, having gone through that trial, at the end of it, his faith was infinitely stronger than it was at the beginning. So God tricked the devil into strengthening Job's faith because he protected it. God protected Job's faith, and through that trial and temptation, grew that faith, and it became even stronger. And it became an example for all of us to grow by the faith. So a lot of times going through that situation, you're like, man, my children died, all my cattle died, all my sheep died, I'm covered in sores. What could God possibly be teaching me through this? We don't know. A lot of time we don't know until the end. Yes, sir.
Did Job really happen, or is it just some story someone's saying that's an allegory?
Every indication I am aware of in Scripture, the references to Job is that it really did happen. Really did happen, yeah. There are some people who will argue that it's an allegory. It's like an extended parable. My golden key question, what in the text leads you to that conclusion, comes into play. If there is a reason to believe that Job is a parable, hopefully there would be something in the text. So Jesus told them a parable saying, ... prefaces a lot of his parables. Right. This is also why you would have something like the Good Samaritan, the text of the Good Samaritan. I believe this is the Good Samaritan is not prefaced by, and Jesus told them a parable saying. Jesus said, and there was a man who was going up or going down to Jericho from, whatever. So the question is, Good Samaritan, was that something that actually happened or was that a parable? It could have happened. I mean, everything described in the situation could have realistically happened. Yes.
I can't remember if this happens to this. Most of the time, this didn't really happen.
Yeah.
It's those arguments are very easily defeated because the New Testament Jesus said, "Well,
yes,
Jonah. Oh, here's the flood."
Yep.
Yeah. Jesus was there. He was the cause.
Yes.
If he said it happened. It happened.
This is so.
These are not open questions. I don't know if you're
Yeah, I'm trying to remember if somebody references Job. I'm pretty sure at some point somebody references Job as though he was a real person. Yeah. This is one of the questions with Jonah. Jonah in particular is one of these stories. By the time you get to the New Testament, a lot of people are saying, well, Jonah was an allegory, it was a parable, it was whatever. But then Jesus references Jonah and says, remember this thing that actually happened? Just like this actually happened, just as Jonah was in the belly of the whale for 3 days, so too will the Son of Man be in. And then he calls it the sign of Jonah. He says, just like this is a real thing that happened, so too will this other real thing happen. So because of that, we know that Jonah is a real story. But yeah, so in regards to Job, there are a lot of people who believe that it was kind of an allegory, a parable. I don't see that in the text. I'm inclined, I mean, there's nothing in the story that couldn't have happened. It could have all happened, right. So unless there's something in the text to lead me to believe that it was a parable, I'm hesitant to even really entertain the idea. Just because this is, I mean, it's usually the tactic is used where people want to say, well, Genesis is a parable. The creation account is a parable. Because if they can undermine the creation account, they can undermine the order of creation, man, then woman. Or they can undermine, you know, sin or any other thing.
It starts, like, okay, did Job even happen? Well, if Job is an allegory, then
what else? Yeah.
Then all of a sudden you've got all these things that end up being allegories and parables.
Yeah, and then the thing is, there's no limiting principle either. If you can just say this story is strange, therefore it didn't happen, well, every miracle then. Water into wine, that's a strange story. That probably didn't happen. The parting of the Red Sea, I don't know about that. That's kind of weird. Maybe that didn't happen. God becoming man? That's insane. It's not even logically possible. How could that? Dying on the cross and coming back 3 days later? I mean, obviously this is an allegory for, yeah. Yes.
Do a lot of people look at Job specifically and they say, well, this story doesn't necessarily sound like the rest of the Bible. It's kind of a little weird, so it must be out of place and maybe it's a parable. And that's how they come to that conclusion, because it does seem like a kind of a random book that's just placed out there in the middle of
Right. Job is unique and distinct, and my understanding is that as far as we can tell, it was actually the oldest book written. So it was written before Moses wrote Genesis. Because remember, Moses wrote Genesis in like Genesis Exodus. He's way down. He's past the flood. He's past the Tower of Babel. He's past a lot of stuff. And so when he finally writes down, this doesn't mean that the stories of Genesis weren't being orally passed down through generations before then. I fully believe they were. But in terms of writing them all down in a book, that doesn't happen until Moses. Job, on the other hand, again, I don't remember exactly how they figured this out, but they kind of determined that Job was probably the oldest book. It was probably one of the first ones written in the Old Testament that we have. It is distinct in style. There is no other book in the Bible that's like Job. It is distinct in content as well. It starts out with this private, like, how would you know that God and the devil were having a conversation?
Right, exactly.
Right. So there's some weird aspects to Job that you don't have. There's problems that you don't have in anything else. So the Book of Kings or Chronicles or something, that's a historical thing. Like we know how those things kind of came about, were written down. Job is unique and different in that way. Because of, I think, some of those aspects, people kind of think, okay, it's different enough that maybe it's an allegory, maybe it's a parable. But I would have to take it on a case-by-case basis. There's some people who just don't want Job to be true. There's other people who say, well, I would love to be able to explain all these details. And the fact of the matter is there's a lot of mystery in the Bible. It's never explained. But yeah. I firmly believe that Job was absolutely a historical account. But yeah, anyways, I'll keep going. Verse 16, do not be deceived, my brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be kind, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. Okay. You may have recognized a couple of words in there. This is being written as though somebody understands, like the book of John, for example, referring to the word of truth. That could be a reference to Jesus coming forth from the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. I think also of the term Jesus Christ as the firstborn from the dead, kind of firstborn, first fruits, first of many type things. Jesus is a firstborn from the dead in the sense that he is the first person that died and, you know, God rose in body and soul, and he will never again die or anything like that. Now, I know there's Elijah, and there's some weirdness with what about Lazarus. But in terms of Jesus as the archetype for what will happen to the Christian, you will die, your body will go into the earth, your soul will go to heaven, and on the last day, your body will be raised again and joined again with your soul, and you'll be able to eat broiled fish on the beach with Peter, just like Jesus did. So the firstborn from the dead means that first Jesus did this, then you're going to do this. This sounds kind of similar to me, that first the first fruits, that after Jesus, the Christians start following in his footsteps. All right, let's see if we can finish this chapter or if we run into something. Verse 19, know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger, for the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God. Therefore, put away all filthiness and rampant wickedness and receive with meekness the implanted word, which is able to save your souls. This is very practical advice. Just think about somebody, you know, this verse being pinned in the corner of your screen when you're on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. It can be very easy to be quick to anger. This is just practically not wise. Rushing to anger rushes you to sin. Verse 22, but be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word, not a doer, he's like a man who looks intently at his natural face in the mirror. For he who looks at himself and goes away at once forgets what he was like. But the one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and perseveres, being no hearer who forgets, but a doer who acts, he will be blessed in his doing. This is a kind of, again, this is a kind of confusing comparison for me linguistically, but it's pretty simple what he's saying. There's a difference between, like, if I tell my kids to do something, they're like, yeah, I hear you. Well, go do it. Go clean up your room. There's a difference between them hearing me go clean up your room and them actually going and cleaning up your room. That's just a practical distinction. Verse 26, if anyone thinks he is religious and does not bridle his tongue but deceives his heart, this person's religion is worthless. Religion is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this. To visit our orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. We're not going to keep reading past there, but there's verses in the Bible that talk about religion. True religion is this sort of thing. A lot of times on Facebook, they'll say, Christianity is a relationship, not a religion. I said, well, it's both. you know, I want to have a relationship with God. Well, everybody has a relationship with God. Well, it's just some of them, it's not a good relationship. Some of them, it's God is the judge. But religion is, you know, the following of the teachings of God. So James chapter 2 is where things get spicy. You've read James chapter 1. You see that he's talking about practical ways of living. He's warning about the consequences of giving into sin. He's talking about somebody who's a hearer and not a doer. Keep this all in mind. This is all important once you get into James chapter 2. James, the book of James does not start at chapter 2. It starts at chapter 1. So with all the context of chapter 1 in mind, that is how you must read James chapter 2, especially when we get to the spicy bits around the verses around the 20th. So we'll get into that maybe next week unless I get completely distracted by something else. Otherwise, let's close with the doxology.